you, everyone. Mr. Curley and Mr. Edgar. Mr. Curley, you've given us a summary. Mr. Edgar, do you have a summary as well?
I don't have a summary.
Good answer. Mr. Curley, care to tell us, read your summary and introduce the additional materials you've provided to us.
Yes.
And we will take you up on the suggestion that we'll, in effect, throw questions in the middle between you, and you two can sort out who is best placed.
Sure. So he does the tough ones, and I do that. So I've just passed you a summary statement, which really just discusses how the amended rules, which are in the second document with the staple, tie themselves to the plan that Mr. Espy has now produced with the moderate to high and high landscape sensitivity areas marked on those. And that the rules just specifically identify or trigger buildings within the moderate to high would trigger a discretionary, and effectively buildings in the high would trigger a non-compliant consent, which will tie the rules back to the rules as proposed by council in respect of the moderate, high and high landscape sensitivity areas. In my summary here, I also discuss a rule where we have reduced in the area AA5, we have reduced the maximum building coverage from 45% to 40%. And there's not a great science behind that, other than when we looked at what that area provided for, that 5% could be lost with still adequate scope to develop in future that area. And obviously there's a net benefit if we were to look at maximum outcomes, a net 5% benefit. At paragraph 8, I've talked just on my logic around site coverage. Mr. Jones had he'd suggested that there was a lack of site coverage control in some areas, and in activity area 1 and 2 through paragraphs 8 to 10, I've tried to explain there how that site coverage would be calculated or effectively achieved or managed. And effectively by capping the maximum number of units in combination with capping the maximum unit footprint, we achieve effectively a maximum site coverage, which if broken as an individual footprint or a maximum number of units would trigger non-complying activity consent. So I've explained the logic there, and if there's any questions in respect of that calculation, I'm happy to answer that.
Thank you, gentlemen. First, cover it off in terms of the kites I was flying in Mr. Espy's direction about what is the correct focus in terms of aerial extent when talking about what maintenance of rural character. What is your view as to what is the correct approach and why?
My view is that the site isn't a landscape in its own right. It forms part of a much wider and broader landscape. The strategic objectives of the plan seek to maintain the landscape character of rural character landscapes, not sites within the rural character landscapes. And I think strategic objective 3252 is relevant.
3252?
Yeah. We're seeking to, where it states the adverse effects on landscape character and visual amenity values from subdivision or development are anticipated and effectively managed through policies and rules. So on my reading of that, that directs council to look at the wider landscape and put in place provisions to assess and manage landscape effects. So the adverse effects of subdivision and development are anticipated and effectively managed through policies and rules, so that landscape character is maintained. As a whole.
I wonder if it's clearer, because I was busy looking at these and while I was having a drink of water as well, if it's made clearer in the policy, 331A talks about maintaining the landscape character and visual amenity values of rural character landscapes.
Mm.
Now, on that score, maybe could have asked Mr. Espy, but I think it's more a planning issue. I know that one of the implicit criticisms the Environment Court made of the PDP provisions in the context of resource consent appeals is that the RCLs are not actually landscapes. They're a default category of every rural area that isn't an O&L, because even so, how do we get over that? That, like, the ODP, the court had quite a clear thing that something has to be basically big enough to be a landscape before it be separately mapped.
Mm.
That was in the ODP appeals when it was first being finalised. So what is a, when you talk about rural character landscapes in that sense, is that, should we take that as literally the landscapes, whatever they are, or should we say the area identified on the plan as RCL?
I think I would say, as the area identified in the plan is RCL.
Now, in relation to the additional material, as a result of Mr. Espy having altered his view and provided us with another plan, we now have structure plan development areas that are within a moderate to high high sensitivity area, and therefore in planning terms are full discretionary activities. What policies would guide the determination of that full discretionary application?
say objective 4622, and its associated policies, which introduces the, I guess, the landscape sensitivity mapping, and discusses enabling and consolidating buildings in the RVZ in areas that are not identified in planning maps as high landscape sensitivity areas, nor within moderate high landscape sensitivity areas. Restricting buildings in moderate high landscape sensitivity. And avoiding buildings in high landscape sensitivity areas. And then the next policy discusses land use and development in particular buildings shall protect, maintain or enhance the landscape character and visual amenity values of the rural visitor zone and surrounding landscape areas. So I think in read together that policy suite provides direction in terms of how to manage buildings or how to assess buildings in the high to moderate high sensitivity areas.
The thought that went through my mind is that sort of you're getting mixed signals here. Like, I understand why the purpose of identifying a structure plan in conjunction with those provisions is, as I understand it, to provide greater clarity and narrow the areas where development might take place within low sensitivity areas.
Mm.
But it's sort of giving for a structure plan to identify a development area in a moderate to high landscape sensitivity area is giving, to me, mixed signals.
Mm.
And does there need to be additional policy guidance, more or less saying, notwithstanding what's on the structure plan for Corbridge, XYZ?
I don't think so. I think the policies are clear enough that just because part of an activity area may project into
or maybe a note on the structure plan. That might be easier, actually.
Yeah. if it was a particular issue, but I think the activity status for buildings within those moderate high landscape sensitivity areas would adequately allow that to be assessed, the effects on the landscape.
If I can just add there, I think what it's looking for is it enables a design response that then that discretion can actually be applied in assessment of the specific design put forward.
That's exactly the problem, isn't it? Mm. It sort of implies that a design response is going to work. I mean, actually, it's full discretionary, so it can be turned down.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's controlled, that's more looking for a design response.
Yeah.
So the fact that the structure plan says this is area A, A1, and the building is here, will that override
I guess says that their discretion gives particular attention to those locations, but I think you're right, that conflict of the controlled on one hand and the discretionary on the other.
Moving now, Mr. Curley, can you give me some sort of basic information to get some, my head around this?
Yeah.
That Mr. Bodding was calculating back from the availability of water. How many residential units all up would the structure plan allow for?
So I thought about this when being discussed earlier, and I think it's quite dynamic in terms of a residential unit. By nature of a residential unit, the council settled on 2,100 litres per day. If we divide times that by 365 days, I think we get in excess of 700,000 litres a year. And if we divide the quantum of water that's available per year, which I think is 977,000 cubic metres of water, which would be so many million litres of water, if you times it by 1,000, and then divide that by the 700,000 odd per unit, we end up with approximately 1,250. But it's more dynamic in that a unit's demand could range from one bathroom or sink to one bedroom to four bedrooms, depending on the configuration or in configuration of units. And that there will probably drive a more detailed design requirement at the time that that design is established. The demand will probably be based on flushing toilets and water consumption based on the actual unit configuration or total combination of. Yeah, I think, and
not on the day between morning tea and now, but isn't that something you would normally have a look at how it would be serviced?
Yeah, I think the site has a tremendous more amount of water than many sites that we're presented with for development. So there's a starting position of a large quantum of water. There's a secondary position of a large ability to store a lot of water as well in the form of, I guess, the reservoir and other, by nature of area, there's other potential there to store water. You're right, but I guess a zone like this, it doesn't get, if we look at the life cycle of something like Millbrook from when it started to where it's got to today, we're probably in the region of 20 years. Now, enabling a zone with capacity moving forward, it's very unlikely that if the zone was approved tomorrow that we have an immediate uptake at full capacity. We're going to have a resource consent that specifies a specific amount of development, which is going to be informed by market demand. And that specific development will require water and servicing, but it will not be all at once. And so when we look at that 1,250 units, or we look at that full capacity that this zoning might enable, I think it's fair to say that incrementally there will be engineering solutions to enable the actual amount, the incremental growth of the zone over time. And when that occurs, you know, as each year goes on, we have technological advances, we have innovations, we wouldn't want to be held to one design outcome now, which in fact there could be a far more efficient or...
It wouldn't be a change, would you?
Pardon me?
It wouldn't be held to it necessarily.
Yeah.
Giving us some assurance. If we do sort of seem to be dragging out of here at the bottom.
Yeah.
Put the 1,200 units or the...
Yeah.
Kind of like 900,000
sure.
Cubic meters
think what's constraining today even perhaps isn't constraining next year. Or to get this golf course off the ground and built and some of these facilities, if a developer faces a particular constraint which might dictate the design put forward at resource consent, it's a constraint that they may seek to alleviate behind the scenes outside of that consent process for the next resource consent. I don't envisage a zone like this being applied for comprehensively in one application with a full comprehensive engineering solution on maximum capacity. I don't think that would be realistic. And I think the upside potentially to council in enabling a zone such as this, or the capacity that a zone like this has, it has far more option by size, has engineering solutions offered by nature of scale, and secondly, by nature of proximity to some of the reticulated services that we're not relying upon, but which are more likely to be available to a site like this than what they are going to be in what we might call a remote location. They're simply not going to have those options. And I think some of the remote location zones, or the rural visitor zones identified for remote locations, they're probably immediately constrained in terms of their ability to come up with good service outcomes, more constrained, I should say, than what the Corbridge land is.
I think you misunderstood the point of my question, Mr. Kelly. I'm merely observing that Mr. Botting had reverse engineered it. What I want to know is, how many residential units does your structure plan enable?
So, well, if you use the term residential units, or...
Like you can differentiate, because the next question is going to be, what is the total population potential on the site? But we'll start with the buildings. There'll be so many standalone units of different size and so many hotel rooms. But what are the totals? Because I didn't go back and start tallying them up.
Yeah, sure.
If there's a convenient table where they're all listed.
A report attached to Mr. Colgrave's
evidence. Yes, sir. It's page 14 of Mr. Colgrave's brief.
It's a useful table 2 on page 14 of Mr. Colgrave's evidence. It is useful, but again, I feel like this project will be more dynamic in what it delivers. We've obviously got these caps. So if you work through our caps on some of the units, we've got 150 in AA1, 100 in AA2, and then we've got the 100 in the worker village before triggering a consent. So we've sort of got 350,
So what table is it? Sorry?
It's page 14 of Mr. Cole.
Well, I haven't got a page 14, so it's not doing me much good.
In his evidence.
Evidence, yes.
And it comes out to a total of 1,252, is that correct? Is that the one we're looking at?
That's correct.
Yeah.
But
build up.
To speak to that, there had to be some hypothetical situation or calculation based on an assumption around demand and what it may look like. And if we work through it, we've got 350 unit equivalents in our fixed or capped areas, subject to further consent needed for more than 100 in the AA5 area. If we then look at the higher density area and the hotel, we're likely to have a unit equivalent demand on services as opposed to an actual unit.
I understand.
Yeah. So that's fairly dynamic based on demand, what that will look like, and we don't have a fixed figure on what that hotel structure may look like, whether that hotel ends up providing less bedrooms or bathrooms or more bedrooms or bathrooms.
If the structure plan doesn't have overall caps of those sort of things, shouldn't it? So I'm just trying to get a handle on what is the total size of this beast that
in terms
that
of people
you're driving, and as the commissioner said, there are all sorts of different limits in different areas, and so I'm trying to get an overall perspective.
Mm.
How many people are going to be on the site, either living, either visiting, overnight visitors, or staff? Is it huge or generally huge?
And we're talking at a maximum built-out
environment. What I'm interested in first is you're saying it's flexible, it's going to take decades. Well, yes, I understand all of those things.
Yeah.
But what is the overall end result in terms of, I say, best estimate and maximum?
Yeah, sure.
4,000 people?
Yeah, I guess I don't have the data on the visitor staying, one, two, or three, or family, but in terms of rooms, I guess, or units, we could be in excess of 1,000.
But if you've got, if you've got Mr. Colby of 1,252 units, so let's assume that mum, dad and the kids are in some, and I'm on my own because no one talks to me in another one, you're going to end up with an average of, say, 2.2. So there's close to 3,000 people, isn't it?
At full occupancy,
That's a too hard.
Yeah, maximum built out and full occupancy, that could be the case.
So full occupancy, sort of 3,000 people.
Full occupancy, yeah. And I don't know if that's realistic based on market economics, but that's right if we were to.
And again, market economics would tell you that around about that 60 or 75% is the sweet spot. So 3,000 would be full occupancy, but you'd generally be aiming for around about 2.5.
Yeah, I guess we could make that assumption now. Certainly, the reason we don't have that hard and fast fact on room dynamics would most certainly be market-driven, which could take different shapes and forms of offering, albeit constrained by the locations that we've set for those.
And to come back to my question, if you, given the extent to which you're reaching for those answers, does the structure plan need to put some limits around those that they're all some overall limits around the total?
I'm not sure if the effective a quantum of people or a quantum of service required, engineering solution required, is a problem. Certainly, the built form and the effect on the rural character landscape is being controlled by the structure plan, but perhaps some of those matters relating to either service capacities, car parking, nature and scale of activity, certainly the servicing aspects could be dealt to at resource consent. And if an application's been put forward that details an outcome that council don't have confidence can be achieved by virtue of engineering standards, then there is at this stage control over those matters, and that control, it's not loose that as an engineer saying it's okay. Certainly at the time of resource consent and under the Building Act, there's codes of practice which certain engineering standards absolutely have to be met.
That was the only questions I had specifically for Mr. Kelly. Do you want to have any for him before we go on to Mr.
General ones.
Right. All right. McGregor about the design purpose, which you start at paragraph 42. You seem to be running over the question of the overall scale of development together with capacity to absorb the development. Well, I read the notified document saying small scale and, but is the question of scale part of the zone purpose? And if it is that a problem for this development, since as Irving has accepted that this thing is many things, but small is not one of them?
No, I don't see it as being a problem. The proposal does provide for a significant amount of development, but it is limited in its scale and intensity, in that there are limits set in terms of floor area numbers and also locational limits through the structure plan. In the zone purpose. Certainly can be interpreted to mean that. I think if it was intended to be small scale, then perhaps those words should have been used. And also looking at it in the context of the notified rural visitor zones, there aren't any limits on density building coverage. There's a limit on the size of buildings at 500 square metres. But if you look at the size of the rural visitor zones that, or the areas of the rural visitor zones that are low landscape sensitivity, they're not particularly small. I had a brief measure up on Council's GIS, and on my measurements, I think forget the name of it.
Arcadia.
I think. Oh, here we go. Walter Peak, the low sensitivity area, I measure at 22 hectares. Arcadia, I measure at 14 hectares. Blanket Bay is 8 hectares, and Cecil Peak is 2.6 hectares. And they're reasonably large areas.
So, what was Blanket Bay?
Blanket Bay was 8 hectares.
Cecil Peak was
it? Cecil Peak.
And Cecil Peak was what number?
2.6.
Thank you.
So they're the low sensitivity areas.
I mean, the council's officers have picked up on that as being a weakness in the zone provisions.
So yeah.
Look to change that.
Yeah.
For other provisions.
Yeah. But I think, in light of that, my reading of the zone purpose and the objectives and policies that follow indicate that it's to be limited in scale and intensity by the extents of the zone that can accommodate development, being the low sensitivity areas. And that's what we've done with the structure plan, is identify the low sensitivity areas, locate the development potential within those areas, and consolidate buildings, which is the policy direction states that buildings should be located and consolidated within those areas.
So you're saying that if all this is limited, there are limits, it doesn't really matter how big they are. I mean, there's no reason.
Well,
overall size,
and that, and those limits appropriately maintain landscape character or maintain and enhance visual amenity values. I wouldn't be able to hazard a guess, to be honest. I mean, there's a huge amount of land. There are lots of river terraces and things like that where that could accommodate development. But
so as long as you drew lines around those, include them all the businesses zones, the limits.
Not by my reading of it.
Because it does seem to be, if I can jump in, it does seem to be quite a feature of the response is the scale and intensity.
Mm.
And it gets to the point I was trying to make earlier, is this development huge or generally huge? Well, it's still, you know, it's a large development.
Mm.
Now, irrespective of the merits of the development, one of the arguments was that the scale was such. But what you're essentially saying is that the limit that's been placed on that scale negates the scale as a argument point. Is that correct?
Doesn't negate the scale as a consideration, but it mitigates the effect.
And it mitigates the effect to the point that, in your argument, that it's acceptable.
Yes.
We'll talk about the whole concept of extending the RV zone as notified. It was clearly limited to O&Ls into the broader landscape. We've got the legal submissions. Now, as a planning concept, I was wondering whether we've got this wrong way around, that it was actually putting RVs in O&Ls that needed special treatment, because otherwise you would never have got them off the ground because of the all of the limits that are contained within the O&L. The policy direction given on development in O&Ls.
Mm.
So it was that which needed to be provided for. But it didn't need to be provided for in RCLs because the rural zone is sufficiently broad and provides for VA through a consenting pathway. Now, this might be the exception that proves the rule, because you could say that this is large enough that it is appropriately the matter of plan change, but is there an argument that, as I say, that the relative difficulty of establishing VA in a O&L compared to an RCL is itself a planning reason why the RV is required in an O&L, but not necessarily required, maybe, but not necessarily in an RCL?
The zone's important if the intention is to provide for visitor industry places in O&Ls, which I believe it is through the strategic objectives and policies. But I don't see that. I don't see that it can't be both, that it can't deal with O&L and RCL. And in my mind, it's in terms of the efficiency of the plan, I think it would be better to have a zone that can be applied more broadly than a niche zone that has to meet specific criteria to be used in terms of location.
Well, another way of talking efficiency is the consequence of broadening it, that there needs to be one set of provisions for RVs and OLs and another set for RVs and RCLs, because I'm conscious that in all of the provisions of the decisions version of, for instance, Chapter 3 that allied them together, the Environment Court says, no, we're going to have policy X, A, to deal with O&Ls, and B, to deal with RCLs, to make those differences clearer.
Yeah.
Is there a similar argument for the RCL provisions that too, if you're going to broaden them, that means for every policy we need an A that deals with those in O&Ls and a B that deals with them in RCLs, with a different test?
Yes, I think you know, in the objectives and policies there needs to be that distinction, so it's clear what the expected outcomes are for the different landscape classifications, and then I think it follows that you would have a separate rule structure or approach for RCL, which we've proposed, which in my view slots in quite easily into the chapter. I mean, we haven't had to rewrite the entire chapter to fit it in. And I think the structure plan approach that acknowledges that rural character landscapes generally can probably accommodate more development than O&L, but in order to manage the effects of that, a bit more detail is required.
Special zone such as this, it's the, I think as Mr. Espy said, we need to look at those parts of the site that are important to the rural, to the broader rural character, and also the effects on the rural character of the surrounding landscape. But you can't hone in on every bit of the special zone and say each and every bit of that needs to have its rural character. So but as I understand it, and I may be mistaken in this, you then move to the zone itself, you then move to Chapter 46 and say, well, this is a sort of in lieu of the rule provisions, you look at how absorb energy or amenity within the zone and manage in that zone itself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mr. Espy said he didn't bother, wasn't interested in that, so he relied on the planners for this. But when you look at the provisions of the zone, I think we went through some of these with the chairman, both the effective one and the policy and the two, they have a sort of similar provisions that say that, say, visitor accommodation and physical recreation are provided to you through the visitor zone only in areas of landscape sensitivity where, in rural character landscapes, landscape character can be maintained. So does that mean the landscape character of the surrounding area or the landscape character of the zone?
I would say the landscape character of the surrounding area, but the landscape sensitivity and the landscape sensitivity mapping is a means of ensuring that the landscape character of the surrounding area is appropriately maintained, but it will also have, it will also maintain some landscape character. It'll be modified, but within the site itself.
So is that because the words rural character landscapes are in capital letters or something like that? Is that referring to bits of the rural, of the rural carved out?
Well, the site, the site would still be classified as rural character landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but it's a different set of provisions that apply because it's an exemption zone.
Yes, so one of
the yeah, not unless otherwise.
We'll just go back to make sure I understand that. I thought that as soon as you took it out, it was an exception zone and those provisions didn't apply.
Yes. But my understanding is that it doesn't negate the classification. It just means that those landscapes are managed in a different way through a different policy framework.
Which 46211, for example, is another one where it says provide for innovative and visitor accommodation, etc., where the landscape character, and if you again use this capital letters, rural character landscapes is maintained, or the amenity values of rural landscape character landscapes are maintained.
Yeah.
So what's it referring to there?
I think that could be taken as where to locate the zone.
Yeah.
locate it in areas where the landscape values are protected or character is maintained. And then it could also apply to the zone itself, locate development within the zone where the landscape character is maintained. I meant that the landscape character outside the zone or in those the high sensitivity areas is maintained, but I think if there was to be no change to landscape character in the RCL, then it would be.
I think I queried this with Mr. Eastby too, and queried his logic on, or his assessment on, while there'll be a change of character, absolutely, that change is still inherently rural by nature of a golf course, would not.
Perhaps you can't really give it the opportunity.
Yeah, that's fair.
We'll maintain this, that's a strong word. So if you look over to 46.222, I'm sorry, it's just so hard to keep moving around. I'm looking for your help. 46.222 is another one, which is in the building part. Land use and development of a particular building shall protect, maintain, or enhance the landscape character and visual amenities of the rural visitor zone and the surrounding rural landscape. So this is a whole different way. You've never got rural character landscape in RCL. Focused on both, in and out.
Yeah.
And it doesn't say the rural character, it just says the landscape character.
Yeah. But then, it says by controlling the colour, scale, design, and height of buildings and associated infrastructure. So I think it anticipates that there will be buildings, but they need to be designed. Inappropriate.
Even in the zone itself.
Yeah.
So that one's clearly anticipating some development in the zone.
Yes.
And it's a change, but it's got to maintain the character of the community.
Yeah.
Whereas these other ones, which have to do with more the location of the zone, seem to use the centralized rural character landscape. But you're saying that relates to outside these bespoke exemption zones, but also in the higher sensitivity areas of even within the zone.
Even that's my interpretation of it, as those areas are to be avoided once built development.
I wonder if there's another alternative. As I understood Mr. Espy's evidence, he was saying that he was looking at the landscape as a whole, both within and without, and saying, well, the effect of this development in this corner was not altering or not was maintaining the landscape as a whole, so that drawing a hard distinction between, unless the policy drives you to do that, is not actually what you should be doing.
Mm. Yeah, I would agree.
And the other point is that the Commissioner's pointing to you, Ms. Grace's revised words, to accommodate extension to the RCL, and the issues that she and you are wrestling with suggest that maybe the answer is we need to have another look at how that's expressed and whether it captures, like, as I said, as I put it, whether the sub-policy that relates to RCLs needs to capture more clearly these sort of issues in a way that's actually workable. Because otherwise you may as well not bother extending it to RCLs if you have a test that no one's ever going to meet.
Yeah, yeah. I think there is a potential resort policy that may come about through topic two, which I don't know what that might look like, but
is
that
resort policy or resort design policy?
Resorts policy.
Yes,
but I don't know what that might look like, but that might shed some light on it. Yeah.
Part of that section is on
yeah.
Approach.
Is that an ongoing conversation?
I believe there has been some expert conferencing on it, or mediation.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that?
Apologies.
Yeah.
Because it had been identified as a whole that there was that there are resorts, but there is no strategic policy for resorts.
Mm-hmm.
But the nature of expert conferencing being until the expert conference report is delivered of its outcome, we don't know where that's going, and we only have an indication that we do have it because that then has to go through the assembled planners conference to produce something else that the court may or may not be happy with.
Yeah.
And we asked you whether the same sort of thing has been rural visitor zones, because like there are specific ones about rural living zones that are quite targeted in chapter 6 or 3, one of them, but up the top there. And something like that about resort zone, which would apply to resort zones predominantly. But of course there were no rural visitor zones when all those appeals and mediation they've now become a special zone, and there is no bridge between chapter 6 and chapter 46 like there is with the rural living and rural residential zones. But of course that's not happening at the moment, and no one's asked for it, but you never know where things are going to go in the long run. But by opening up 36 from 4 existing sites in the RML, it has opened up all sorts of need to finesse the word in this chapter and between the chapters.
Yeah.
Okay, well, either of you can answer this, but why haven't you applied at some stage in the planning process for a resort zone? Given that, I think even your legal submission say it is a resort. Even though, I know you say it doesn't need to be a resort zone, but in terms of it is a resort.
Do you mind if I ask a question? Do both these witnesses agree that it meets the definition of resort?
Yeah, which is interesting. I mean,
yes.
Yes,
yes
or no, and then
yes,
we can go back
yes.
to your question.
Okay,
yeah.
So you agree with
yes.
Yes,
the
right. Yeah. So then I think you can ask your question, which is why it hasn't been.
So what? Yes. Okay, so if it is a resort, and there are resort zones and have been for many, many years resort zones in this plan, why at some point along the planning process have you not asked or thought of a resort zone? And I mean, we noticed that Gippsland Bay Station now has a resort zone.
Gibson Valley
Resort
Times. Something. Who would have thought? Who would have
thought?
Yeah.
So, what happened? Why was either that not possible in your view, or not available, or
is
not appropriate?
Or is it not
appropriate?
And also, is it not available yet?
Can I perhaps answer the question on Gibson Valley, because I did look at that and how they got their resort zone. as I had understood it, they sought amendments through stage 1 to the sort of rural zoning. So it was a little bit like what we've done here, where they asked for changes to an existing zone and then through the mediation process have achieved a resort zone.
Mm.
Yeah. So that's the sort of where the qualified yes comes from about being able to establish a resort zone through this process. So in essence, it was, I think sort of amendments to the existing zone they sought in stage one that's morphed into a resort zone through the appeals, as opposed to seeking a specific resort zone in their submission on stage one.
I mean, you're seeking here a bespoke rural visitor zone that is completely different from the one that was notified. So you could have, like Hedgeston, asked for a bespoke bit of rural zone that was effectively a resort zone and then morph it at some point.
2015.
Or just have a bespoke piece of rural zone.
I think, and I wasn't working alongside the submitter at that time. I believe it wasn't on their agenda at that time, to going back to, I guess, 2015. And I do believe the communication at the time when rural visitor zones or different types of rural visitor zones were put forward at stage one, that the council postponed effectively those zones when the rural visitor zone would be reviewed.
But I understand that most of the people then were asking for the old to be brought in through stage one, and the council certainly could put those people off.
Yeah, and then so when the rural visitor zone was notified, there was probably some, definitely that awareness that it had been somewhat tailored, although the Section 32 had said we have this demand for people in the rural to experience rural amenities and so forth, the visitor industries to be placed. We then had the strategic policy saying that, you know, it could be placed in our districts. It didn't shoehorn it into the O&Ls. So there was that awareness that these rules and this policy do tend to want to point all of these into the outstanding natural landscape or, at that time, remote landscape. So we are aware of that detachment with.
In your Section 32, you looked at a resort zone versus a RV zone, and I mean, they came out quite close, well, first and second or something. In your design and your table, you quite strongly put within the benefits for the RVZ of housing, for example, why did RVZ come out better than the resort zone in your Section 32?
I think there's one of the benefits of the resort zone. I noted that the special zone chapter can be developed to enable a wider range of activities than the rural visitor zone. I would say that could potentially extend to a greater proportion of residential activity. But I think overall, I felt that the rural visitor zone was appropriate. The proposal could be fitted into it relatively easily. So there's efficiencies there rather than waiting and relying on another plan process or review. So in terms of acting now and being able to provide for the development, I felt that the rural visitor zone was appropriate, so it was a preferred option.
Because you could ask for it in stage three, which you couldn't do for the resort zone.
Mm. I think the amendments we suggested to the zone to allow for limited residential activities are appropriate and acknowledge the existing consent for the 35 dwellings. I think there are, from the evidence, there are benefits in having a residential component in this type of activity. So if we were if it was a straight choice today of a resort zone including the residential component versus rural visitor zone without any residential, I think the resort zone would be better.
So I mean, I'm not wanting to go on that too much. I'm just saying, you don't think the resort zone's inappropriate.
No.
It's just that it, in terms of the cost and benefits to your client, it requires waiting in another process and a bespoke zone into the plan.
I think.
Whereas now you can.
Yeah, and I think that leads you back to efficiency. And efficiency of the plan, whether the plan could include a rural visitor zone that can be applied more broadly, or the plan needs to include a whole load of special zones, and you end up with. But
so pushing it to say it fits easily and with minimal amendment to the RB zone, maybe on the policy side, we try to do, but we can't really think of an importance.
And I think that comes down to this. We were aware that it's a large scale land holding with the structure plan accommodating, you know, effectively the rules were tailored to fit the structure plan approach. I guess that's how those rules came as opposed to leaving it open for what was proposed for the RVZs more as notified. No, I think a lot of them we could have, but we actually think given the scale of this property, those RVZ rules would have enabled too much, whereas I feel like...
Well, they wouldn't have to be had at 500 square metres per site.
No, it's per building though, so...
Oh, no.
But no site coverage, etc. So when we started creating, when we were informed of the parts of this landscape that could accommodate development, we became aware that it was substantial, then we decided to create rules that tailored to the structure plan outcome.
Which is sort of what the resort zone provisions in the existing plan do for those sites, don't they? And the structure plan and the areas and...
Yeah, correct. And I'm not entirely sure on the exact sequence of how they came about, but I do believe they were more fitting to consenting outcomes. You know, I don't believe that Millbrook was a blank slate before it started. I could be misguided there. Yeah, I feel like a resort could be established effectively in these RVZs that are being identified, with the exception of the intent of residential. If there's residential activity for on-site staff and you raise this in respect of the complexities of allowing other people to stay, families or so on, their renaissance will be a proportion of residential in the RVZs, and technically I think if you evaluate the definition of a resort, any of the RVZs in Wakatipu are likely to be able to be defined as a resort once there's residential activity within those RVZs. So in some ways we're discussing whether the resort fits is a better fit for this, but I think a resort by definition could eventuate in any of the RVZs. Yeah. Yeah, correct.
Or that are any of the notified?
The notified RVZs could eventuate with development that could be defined as a resort by nature of on-site residential. Well, I think that's problematic, you see, because I think if, you know, using the example of Walter Peake wanting to hire a fantastic chef, it's unlikely that, as I think you've alluded to, that, well, we can hire you, but can we somehow hire your wife? You know, and so there's going to be those complexities, so inevitably there'll be a portion of a family or an entity, perhaps, other than a single person, which will be just undertaking residential activity.
Squeeze one little question in there. Just to flip that round, if we go through this, because if you look at the, and this is your analogous analysis, Mr. Edgar, about the resort zone versus the RVZ zone to get here, and the top four are all to do with staging, just the process. Right? So if we go through this process and we end up with a resort zone, as part of this process, would you or your client be upset by that as an outcome?
I guess what we've proposed is that it's not a necessary step, but I guess I could say that our client would achieve, in essence, what is submitted to be appropriate on the land by way of a bespoke resort zoning. a bespoke zone, yeah. Another special zone, I guess.
Which goes to the, if it looks like a resort and smells like a resort, you know, irrespective of which zone it fits into.
I think you're right, but I wonder whether that smell of a resort and look of a resort is being associated with a golf course, perhaps. I mean, a lot of the facilities being proposed here could occur on the RVZs as notified.
You could say that with regard to the hotel.
Which could be established on a notified RVZ.
Okay.
So I think, in my mind, the golf course was more of a rural and recreational opportunity than it was necessarily a resort, it being exclusively tied to a resort.
I guess I've changed the way it's used. I included often remote in the purpose to acknowledge that rural visitor zones are appropriate in the O&L.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
It's more of a, like a description. Don't be surprised to find
I have given it some thought. I think the strategic provisions seek to enable visitor industry activities in both the O&L and the RCL. So I think it's appropriate to provide for that both, you know, throughout the district. I don't necessarily think by removing remote and the requirement that they're in the O&L necessarily opens the rest of the district up to private plan changes that wouldn't otherwise occur. If a landowner is particularly motivated, they could seek a private plan change for a special zone or a resort zone. I think it, to my mind, it just makes for a more efficient plan and a more efficient process of considering those zones.
Make
the to remove from all. Like it happened, yep. It's hard to say how much land there might be in the RCL that could accommodate a rural visitor zone. I expect that there'll be more than there more by proportion than there is in the ONL. I think it would also be determined by demand. If there's demand for rural visitor activities in the RCL, then yeah, you may see more private plan changes seeking the application of the rural visitor zone. I think there's a counter to that as well, that if you leave it as remote and ONL, are you then directing anyone who wants to provide for rural visitor activities to look in the ONL?
Talk about directing development, but effectively recruitment actually doesn't provide for it, doesn't direct it.
Yeah.
It's more like saying, well, you can, it's allowable as opposed to.
Yeah, but I suppose the point you were making about opening the zone up to the wider district, is that going to lead to more instances of the rural visitor zone being sought in those areas? The counter is perhaps if you're limiting it to those areas, is that going to result in more instances of the zone being sought in those sensitive areas?
Yes. Yes, correct. So, so if we go to the yes, so the
25 and 26.
Yes, correct. 25 and 26. No.
So, you know how there are two tables, this 46.6 and this 46.2?
Yes.
One's called activity and one's called standard.
Yes.
So, do you understand the difference?
Yes. Well,
the ones that are the activities that have got activity status applied to
Yes, I acknowledge that.
So you can come along complying activity either by being listed as one and taking 46.6 or by not meeting the standard where non-compliance is the status for non-compliance.
Yes, I accept that. Yes.
So most of the ones that you have come over from the previous table are okay, but when you get down to like building materials and colours, that's it. Isn't that a standard? Like what it says in the other zone, the other bit of the zone, is that the bit in the column with the writing in it.
Yes, yes, I can see.
A standard. Any building must be grey 20%. Blah blah blah.
Correct.
And if you don't do that, you are weak.
Yes,
so.
So
you see how that's a standard?
Correct.
And that
I do accept that. Sure. Yes, I accept that. I think what my attempt was to do was that would apply to absolutely any.
Yeah. Absolutely everything section of your standard.
Sure.
So you need it absolutely a different standard. Okay. So then you get to 46.7 and these aspects.
But
the first one, I think it needs to be a standard, but you've written it as an activity that says the duct construction of more than 150 accommodation units is NC.
Okay.
And then similarly 46.7 duct construction. So should you really write it like you have some of the others, there shall be no more than, or something. I mean, yeah.
That does make sense to me. Yes.
But you do mean that. You do mean that accommodation units in the theoretical accommodation area are permissive, presumably, as long as there aren't more than 150 of them.
Correct. So the buildings are still controlled, but the definition of a unit or the configuration of a unit is capped.
So I just think, I mean, some of that, you may want to put some of that over in the activities table.
Sure.
Okay. Up to 150 units,
yes.
Whatever it is, permissive or controlled. But, I mean, it's up to you. But
I think that's logical what you've explained.
I mean, I'm not wanting to say exactly how to do it, but I think you just, I mean, if you're starting a position with you don't know the difference between an activity table and a standard table, we'll work it out and sort it out. Now, the accommodation units, you don't define that.
Yes.
There is a definition of visitor accommodation, which there's no more than 90 days, and all those sort of things come with it. So if you just mean a unit to be used for visitor accommodation, if that's what you mean.
Call it a visitor accommodation unit.
That's what you mean.
Absolutely.
Then you need to start using defined terms.
Okay.
And sticking to them. Otherwise, you have to provide a whole lot more definitions. And residential activity is defined. And residential unit is defined.
Yes.
And so if you mean a worker's accommodation unit is a residential unit that can only be used by people working on the site, then you need to start saying that so that the activity or the unit is a residential unit. The standard is that it can only be used by workers. Workers and their families and their friends and their aunts and uncles and anyone else. If that's
sure,
what you mean.
Sure.
But you do need, because otherwise we've got pandemic coming here.
guess I was.
It needs the final because it's open to years of argument. Your grandmother is allowed to live in your workers' accommodation.
Only if she's cleaning your house.
Or minding your children while you're on holiday.
I think it was trying to remove any ambiguity that it certainly wasn't a for residential activity, so that the attempt was to remove it to never be reflected.
It's
for
not a residential activity.
Well, ultimately, worker accommodation is, I think, is your point. It is residential unit, effectively.
It's not as defined. Not a residential activity as defined.
It is, yeah.
It's got further standards applied to who can use it, like in the old days, we used to have family flats or something. There's minor residential units now, so they're just a residential unit that's small. But in the past, they might have been a residential unit that could only be used by a dependent member of your family or something like that.
Break it down.
You've got to break it down, because otherwise you're overlapping with defined terms. You're not using those defined terms and you're bringing up other terms that aren't defined. And you can do that by way of standards applied to defined terms and limitations of defined terms, but you've got to differentiate from your defined activity or your group form and the standard that might apply.
Yes.
So, but are you, for your clients and for what you're putting forward, though, irrespective of how you define that, who do you think can live in a workers' accommodation unit?
I think it's problematic that it's designed, or the zone would encourage the ability for workers, staff, members to be accommodated on site.
Does it even say that it has to be a worker that's working on the site?
It refers to staff accommodation.
And your
No, so it doesn't mention site.
Design.
But it does say work accommodation units.
I mean, lots of people do.
Yeah. So the intent was.
We've already had one of your witnesses even today talking about great pickers down the road. And it's quite a lot of your evidence talks about wider, but I think
we've narrowed it down as time's moved on, and certainly the intent, I can clarify, is for the person who may be able to reside there, that they're employed in the rural visitor zone.
Cool. So how is that going to relate to construction staff or contractors?
No, and I think
another firm who might be working on that site one week and then another site another week.
Correct. I think it's very problematic, as proposed on the RBZs generally. I think it's a real issue that there's no standards that would create a certain type of accommodation that would be utilitarian to just workers or maybe what.
But yours has opened up more, so let's deal with your problems rather than the wider problems. Now, are you thinking you would try and define that, or would you just leave it as work for accommodation use?
I think it needs to be defined to include on site or.
Because if we go making a decision on this wording, it means anyone working anywhere in New Zealand, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So it needs to attach these to the zone that's been proposed. That's right. Yeah.
And then if we have got a problem, and I expect that it's potentially a problem with the existing on-site accommodation, that if someone's partner happens to work down the road or somewhere else, that could be a problem for all the zones.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. That needs to be attached. It needs to be reworded.
And you need to think about what you need
your families or what. Is it employees or does it include contractors?
Contractors. Yeah, exactly. They're more free to take on other contracts. It's a pretty slow, but it's definitely, I don't mean in a disparaging way, I mean in a drafting way.
Yeah, sure.
Because it does go to the essence of what this activity is when you're asking for it as a different activity than what the
I accept that. Yeah, it works out less. I think it may be, yeah. It was less than that, and so the 45, it was considered, it seemed, it was similar to the medium density zone in urban areas.
So residential activity, the purpose of on-site construction. Oh, okay, so this is where you're tying it into residential activity. So yeah, you don't want to work together.
Detached.
And then you'll probably say the other residential activity.
There's a catch-all non-complying rule at 46.627.
I go right back. I've only got one remaining question, I think, because I think they've been well covered by the others. I really like your collective planning law. You might have different opinions in terms of assisting us, not so much the view of Corbridge. And it goes to this whole issue of the extent of the zone. We've had a big discussion about that, and Mr. Edu, I think even though you've only used a few words to change the objectives and policies, I think in doing it you've quite fundamentally change what the purpose of the notified zone was, which is clearly your intention, that's fine. Mm. We've had a number, we've had, I think, about 14 other requests for this zone. I think from memory, each of them have asked for some bespoke provisions within it. And it could have been 20 or 25 or 35. The question I've got to you, in efficiency effectiveness section 32 arguments or 32AA, is it your professional opinions that a zone like this should be retrofitted with a whole number of bespoke provisions, and picking up Commissioner Dawson's question about what the implication of changing the zone is to the rural character landscapes, or is it your view that in a Section 32 argument it really needs to be sort of sat back and look at this in a proper strategic context and bring it through in a different way, i.e. through a different plan change? So the question really is it efficient to be doing it 14 different times with a whole set of bespoke provisions, or should it be looked at in a more strategic sense if the zone is to be expanded the way that you've recommended it is?
It's hard to say without being familiar with the other submissions and the relief sought in terms of the how they would fit within the zone. I expect that if more than, you know, if multiple submissions were to be approved, then there'd be some work to do to, in terms of the layout of the chapter and the rules and how they work together, and ensuring there's no inconsistency, and possibly looking at whether bespoke rules between.
Can I just put it a different way? Is that a legitimate issue for us to look at in terms of overall recommendation? Or is it your view that we should just, to use the term, crack on and deal with each of them individually and decide whether each is acceptable, but then you end up with a zone which is very different than what was notified, plus a whole series of bespoke? So I suppose I'm just asking, is that a legitimate question that we should be asking and considering?
I think you should consider them individually. That may end up with there being quite a few different parts of the chapter with their bespoke rules, but
and policies,
yeah.
Well,
yeah. But yeah, I think you probably have to look at them individually. I think the Corbridge submission slots in relatively easily in terms of not rewriting the or not amending the structure of the chapter significantly. There are some changes to the objectives and policies that do open it up a bit, but as I say, we haven't rewritten the.
So just to be clear, so you think each submission should rise and fall on its merits, and we shouldn't sit back and look at it in a more strategic context?
I think each submission should be looked at on its merits, but I think that there would be an element of looking at it strategically and whether there can be any streamlining of the bespoke rules, possibly. But
thank you. I'm happy not to take any further. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Clare. No questions that I haven't already asked, I do believe. And acknowledge again, this is batting slightly above my pay grade.
Now, Mr. Curley. Commissioner Dawson has effectively invited you to reconsider your revised rules in the light of.
I didn't hear that.
Well, I wasn't going to say that. But.
Yeah.
Every day's a learning day.
Yes, sir. That's why I'm a lawyer and not a planner. That I'll give you the opportunity. We're not saying we're directing you to do it, but you have the opportunity, and this is indeed a drop dead time of the essence deadline. 2 p.m. Today. And if it's 2:01, if it's 2:01, it'll come back by return.
That's fine. Sounds good.
But I think while it's been no doubt a little wearing for those in the back row, especially those paying for it.
So I'm taking two seasons of crop to pay for this, don't worry about it.
That I think that's very useful. Mm-hmm. Very grateful to the entire Corbridge team for the assistance. As you can say, we're wrestling with all of these issues, but thank you for your assistance on this submission and the extent to which it's cast light on the many other submissions we have to consider. And on that happy note, I'll adjourn the hearing until Tuesday, 9 a.m., mm-hmm. Tuesday the 11th. And see some of you next week. Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, I presume you chose to come last on the last day, so you get the wisdom of our 14 other submissions.